Mr. Edwards, Reel 6. We're talking about, we've got to the point where you were lagering on the night of the 27th of June over to the 28th of June next morning. What happened next? What's the next thing you remember?
Well, the next morning we stayed in the same area. We took up defensive positions in the same area. And nothing much happened. In fact, I don't remember what's happening at all that day. There were infantry around where we took up position for, but there were some infantry around. But it was pretty quiet the next day, which would be the 28th. And I can't remember much more except that at some time, whether it was that day or the next day, we moved down towards the River Odon, where the rest of the regiment was.
Now, the C squadron had gone over the Odon, I think, to point 112.
That's right, yeah.
And you moved forward to support. Did you actually go over?
I don't remember going over the river, no. But I don't remember going over the river. So whether we did or not, I can't remember.
See, as far as you're concerned, you were occupying defensive positions from the 28th for quite a while.
Well, for the 28th anyway, but as I say, after that I can't remember much, but what day did Epsom finish? I don't know.
Right. It seems to be round about the 30th, the 31st.
Round about then, we finished up with the rest of the regiment all parked on a hillside. This, on our side of the Odon River.
And what happened there? Well, what was happening?
Nothing. Except could hear minis going over, but they weren't landing near us. In the night, you could hear this eerie whistle coming over, and then we acquired a corporal then in place of Corporal McCarty. I can't remember his name. He said this whistling sound that we could hear was the guns of HMS Rodney and Nelson off the coast firing. They were about 14 miles away, and they were going over the top of us about 5 or 6 mile high, I suppose, and that was the little whistle we could hear.
So you were sort of in reserve. Would that be for about 2 weeks or...?
Well, we were in reserve for 2 weeks, but in that time we had to go and support the infantry in their positions, which were opposite L112. And we went up, in the first week we went up for a couple of days, and then the second week we went up for a couple of days. And we just had to sit up there in the infantry positions, and if there was any enemy activity, we had to move forward and sort of shoot at it to save the infantry giving away their positions.
So, but not much happened in a sense then, or?
Not much. You used to get mortared. One night we got a terrible deluge of mortars coming down on us.
I think that might have been on the 1st of July to the 2nd of July. What do you remember of that? What was it like under mortar fire?
Well, in the tank it was all right. The tank swayed a bit with the blast and sprung back up of it. And in the tank I didn't worry about it. When I was outside, I used to dive into a trench if there was one, or a ditch, or under the tank. It was frightening if you were out of the tank, because they sounded as if they were coming right down on top of you. But in the tank, I didn't used to worry. I used to think, if one comes through the hatch, I won't know anything about it, but otherwise, it's all right. I used to be sorry for it. The infantry were outside, I might have been in amongst it.
Now,
but they certainly were terrific bangs, these mortars. I mean, you can't imagine what they're like until they drop around you.
So, anything else about this period?
Yes, a few things happened in the fortnight. Because we used to park in a wheat field when we went up with the infantry. And one day, there's about 15 enemy fighters came over, and they were circling above us aimlessly, as if they were arguing amongst themselves where they were going to go next, and they were just circling above us, and each tank had a heavy brown 0.5 caliber Browning on the turret, and soon all the tanks were blazing away with these Brownings, and the crew were all sort of taking it in turns, hey, let me have a go and all that. Nobody hit anything because you could see the trace of curving away underneath the planes.
So they were too high.
Well, they were too high for the guns, evidently. Unless the bullets go a bit higher than the tracer, because the tracer are a bit lighter than the bullets, so the bullets might have got a bit higher up. But nothing got hit, evidently. And there were this stooging around, and we were all blazing away. I mean, at least they knew not to come any lower, but after a bit, they all flew off, and that was it. But I thought, well, what a funny... At least we all had a good shoot with the Browning, heavy Browning. And that was that little incident. Another time, when we'd been up with the infantry, we came back, and I got my blanket, used to have a ground sheet and three blankets. Well, I got my blanket roller spread out on the ground to try and sort it out. What I didn't mention was that while we were in reserve, just in this wheat field, just behind the front, we used to dig a big hole about 2 feet deep and run the tank over the top of it. And then we used to sleep in the hole, which was a bit safer than anywhere else. And also, if there was any mortar fire or shell fire, we could, somewhere to dive into in the daytime. Anyway, I unrolled my bedding roll to try and get it sorted out of it, because it had got in the mess. And I got it nicely folded up and started out. And while I'm doing that, we heard the shower of mortars screaming down on us, and we all dived in the hole. Everybody dived in the holes. Everybody had a hole to dive into. And when we came out, my bedding roll was just covered in rocks and bits of steel and God knows what, because there was a hole. One had landed about 4 or 5 yards away from where the bedding roll was. So it's a good job I moved. Also, when we first got into this wheat field, because we used to use the same wheat field all the time, there's this terrible smell, dead body smell, and somebody's wafting over. Anyway, somebody had a search through the wheat, and they found this this German NCO dead. It was rotting away, must have been dead a while. So there was a slit trench near him, so we enlarged the slit trench and buried him in it. One brave soul went through his papers and got all his papers and that out to give to the padre. Everything like that used to give to the padre to eventually he could inform the next of kin, I suppose.
So what did you think of the Sherman in action so far? Did you see what I mean? Because
well,
the real day when they sort of showed themselves up was at Goodwood rather than Epsom. What did you think of them?
Well, we weren't too unhappy at the time. We knew what could happen, but we were sort of okay with it at the time.
Had you lost any friends?
Not B Squad, and I don't think I had any casualties in Epsom. We didn't have any casualties.
He still didn't have much to do with ANC, Gilmore.
No, he was there. He was there, and we heard him on the radio, of course, and we used to see him very occasionally, but we didn't have any close contact.
How did the radio work in action? I mean, could you just give us an idea of what it was like for you? Because you were, when you were acting as loader wireless operator, what was it like in action on the radio?
Well, you had what was called filter through, so you could, even though you could hear what was going on the radio at the same time as the intercom was being used.
So you could have them both on?
You could talk to on the intercom, and you could, well, no, filter through. You could hear it coming through. To speak on the radio, or to hear it properly, you had to turn the knob, and you got the full volume. But while you were busy loading and such like, you used to have just on the intercom, and you could hear the commander quite clearly, of course. But you could hear as a background, you could hear
the rest of, because all the crew were on this intercom.
Yeah,
they all had headphones.
They could all hear this background of the radio. Yeah.
So they could hear that, and then when you switched to intercom,
I switched off intercom onto the radio.
Yes,
I could speak on the radio, or the commander could switch on, and he could speak on the radio.
So when you
but
were
only I and the commander could speak on the radio.
And when you were on intercom, you couldn't speak. You could hear them, but you couldn't speak.
You couldn't broadcast.
Now, I believe a lot of people got them confused.
Oh, yeah. Well,
did that happen?
Lots of commanders used to used to speak on the, thinking he was speaking to the driver when he was actually broadcasting, and which was a nuisance, you see, because it blocked the airways. Other people couldn't use the radio then. But that happened a time or two, and then somebody would come up and say, "Hey, set." Get them off eventually, but that did happen.
And I believe some people said some unfortunate things. Would that?
I suppose they did. Yeah, I don't remember.
You don't remember that.
I don't remember anything especially, but I suppose they did at times. Yeah.
Now, anything else before Goodwood? Anything else you remember? It's quite a thing in itself, the move to Goodwood, really.
Yes, well,
because it was a shift of front, wasn't it? Yeah. Well, not front, but
yes. Well, on the, I think it was the 16th of July, we moved from where we were over to we moved east anyway, towards the canal. And the river and the canal. In the night we moved and arboured in a wood, a big wood, hidden.
Would that be northeast of Ranville, or in the Ranville area?
No, it wasn't near Ranville. No, it was on the west side of the river, and the canal. We moved into this big wood, and when all the tanks were in the night, some blokes went out with tree branches to rub out the tracks, because it was supposed to be top secret. And we hid in the wood all day.
Looks like it might be gazelle.
I think
concentration area.
I think that's it, because Ron Forbes knows the name of these, and Ron Cox knows the name of these places, so that's probably it. And so we stayed there all day, and in the evening, the troop officer gave us a briefing on what was going to happen the next day.
Now, what was the briefing from? Was that still the same troop officer?
No, we had a new troop officer then.
So,
Mr. Buchan.
What was he like? Do you remember his first name?
No, he was Scottish. He was Scottish, Lieutenant Buchan. He'd been with us at Aldershot.
And what was he like?
He was in his 20s, I suppose, about 24 or something like that. That's all I remember. He was Scottish, and he was just a troop officer. I mean,
any good?
We thought he was to start with.
And he still had Truscott?
Sergeant Truscott, yeah. And some other sergeant, I can't remember. He might have been called Baelish, but I'm not 100% sure.
So what was his briefing like? What sort of thing would he tell you?
Well, to start with, he told us that we were going to do a big advance the next day, and that we would be the left-hand troop of the left-hand squadron, and that we had to move all the HE ammunition out to the left-hand side of the tank over to the right-hand side of the tank. And I thought, what a bloody daft idea. Anyway, and then he said, it's not going to be too bad. We're going to do this big advance south, and we're going to have an artillery barrage of 600 guns firing in front of us. And we're going to have a 1,200 planes carpet bombing. So he says it won't be too bad. So,
did you believe him?
Well, we sort of. And then we started on moving this ammunition. I thought, what a daft idea, moving all the, because I had it all organised around the tank. There's so much HE and so much armour piercing and so much smoke in each. Ammunition bin, which I think were four ammunition bins altogether.
So you seriously moved all your HE ammunition from the left-hand bins to the right-hand bins?
I moved some that I could get at easily, and then I left the rest, and I thought, blow it. Because I thought it was a daft idea. I thought it was shells going to come in. It's not the HE that's the fault. It's the cordite charging, the propellant charge that catches fire when the shell comes in. It just flashes like it catches fire immediately. And the HE isn't a bother until the whole thing is burning and they start blowing up. So I thought it was a daft idea, and I just changed I made a sort of token movement of changing a few that I could get at easily and left it at that. And then the next in the night, then we moved again in the dark, and we moved across the on the that airborne bridge across the canal and the bridge and the river. And when dawn broke, we were near Ranville, near where all the gliders were parked that had dropped there on D-Day. The 6th Airborne gliders, they were all lying about. And we had the odd can of petrol on the back, so we filled up the tank so it was well topped up. And then we went and had a look at these gliders, and I was looking inside these gliders because some were damaged and wrecked. And I was thinking back to the time when they were landing. I thought, the poor devils coming down in these death traps. And also what I looked at was some beautiful webbing. I don't know if it was nylon or what or the fibre, but some beautiful webbing that they had inside for holding all the equipment in place, like jeeps and things. And I thought, I could do with some of that, but then I thought it would be vandalism, so I didn't touch any of it. But I thought, what a shame to leave all this beautiful webbing there, going to rot. Anyway, then shortly after that, all these planes came over, what looked like thousands of them, and went ahead and bombing somewhere in front of us. And then we moved. They had some tape. There were minefields in front of us, and they had some lanes taped through these minefields. So we all went through the minefields in single file, and formed up in formation on the other side.
Now, was that a problem? Because there has been some talk that it was like a bottleneck, and that this was a big problem. But no one's mentioned it particularly in the Fife and Four Fire. So perhaps you were the head of the bottleneck. I mean, well, wasn't much of a problem.
I don't know, because I'm just in the loader sitting inside the tank. I can't see a lot, and I don't know all that much is going on.
We're hanging about a lot.
But we didn't seem to hang about a lot. We just moved through these lanes and got information on the other side. And A Squadron were in front of us, lined up in a single line, and we lined up, got behind them in a single line, but towards the left of them. And I believe the 3rd Royal Tanks were over to the right of us. And while we were lined up, the barrage arrived.
And what was that like?
Well, a lot of it fell amongst us. So it didn't bother us, but we could see it was all falling amongst us. I thought, well, there's no chance of getting out of the tank even if you want to. And there's an order came over to close your hatches. Don tin hats and close your hatches. Well, we didn't have any tin hats handy, but the commander's closed his hatch. All the other hatches were closed anyway. And we sat there for some time with this barrage falling on us. And then somebody must have got the word, and the barrage started moving forwards, and we moved forward with it. And we went forward slowly with A Squadron in front of us, to the left rear of them, for 2 miles or more, it was 2 miles or 3 miles, and we came to this big railway embankment. All we saw on the way, by the way, was German vehicles burning, German trucks burning. We didn't see anything else nothing to shoot at anyway.
And you got to this first embankment?
We got to this big railway embankment, and we had to sort of break formation to climb over it, because everybody was going up a path, or a track, a diagonal track, to get over this embankment, because it's quite a big steep one.
You're very vulnerable going over an embankment if there's artillery and the old tanks on the other side.
Nothing happened while we were going over. We got down at the other side and sort of formed up in position, in formation again, and got moving again in the right direction. Now, we'd only gone about, I don't know, not very far, half a mile or so. And the troop leader, who I could see was slightly in front of us, moved half left and went through a hedge. So we moved half hedge to his, to get formation with him, kept to the left of his, and we went through the hedge. And as we went through the hedge, and there's always a bit of an embankment at the bottom of the hedge, went up the embankment, over the embankment, and dropped it down at the other side, and then the tank stopped and wouldn't go any further. And then just at that moment, while we're messing about and trying to get the tank free, gunfire came in from the left-hand side.
Now, hang on. Why had the tank stopped?
Well, we didn't know at the time, but there was a big log there, and we bellied on top of the log. We just dropped down, bellied on top.
As you went through the hedge?
Well, I mean, obviously we couldn't see what was at the other side of the hedge, and we climbed up the bank and dropped on the other side and dropped straight onto this big log that was there, and it bellied us so that the tracks weren't touching.
No, so you turned left, but this fire was coming from even further to the left.
Well, it was coming from our left, half left from us at the time, because it was actually coming in left of the squadron. And as this fire came in, the squadron leader said, told our troop to stop and face the gunfire, you see.
Now, was it 88 fire, or was it tank fire?
It was 88, we didn't know what it was at the time, but it was 88 anti-tank guns, dual purpose guns. We were told to stop and face the fire. Now, the troop leader never answered because he got brewed up by it. But I didn't know. Anyway, as the fire came in...
So that would be Lieutenant Buchanan?
Buchan, yeah.
Buchan, sorry.
As the fire came in, our corporal got to pat on firing back. They could see the fire coming sort of off the horizon. So it might have been coming over the horizon, but it seemed to be coming off the horizon. So he had him firing back where it was coming from. But of course he didn't know any range and he couldn't spot it exactly. But we were firing HE, lots of HE back. I said about 20-odd HE, and I was sweating cobs for doing rapid fire, because you could do quite rapid fire with
that. Now, who'd taken over as gunner? Sorry, I'm sorry,
Pat Kettery was back as gunner, because we had a corporal in place of Corporal McCarty, you see.
Do you know his name?
No, I don't know his name.
Sorry, you did say you did.
He wasn't with us long.
So you were engaging this 88mm, but with difficulty, with HE?
Well, he was shooting back with more in hope than anything, because he could see exactly where it was coming off the horizon, but that's all. He didn't know the range or anything. So we were firing lots of HE back, just in the hope of hitting something. The shots were coming off this, I only had a chance to look through the periscope once or twice, but they appear to be coming straight at you. You can see armour piercing coming at you, because it's got a tracer, you see, so you can see them coming at you. And they appear to be coming straight at us, and they were going past us, this terrific whoosh. I thought, good God, it sounds like Hitler's secret weapon. This terrific whoosh going past us, so they were only just missing the top of the tank, I suppose.
And you were still trapped, or stuck?
We were still stuck. But anyway, they were going over the top of us, and we didn't know at the time, destroying Sea Squadron, who were by the bend, got more or less level with us, you see.
So they were the other side of the hedge?
They were to the right of where we were, and yes, I don't know how far they were away, but a couple of hundred yards, 200 or 300 yards, I guess. Now,
was anyone actually shooting at your tank at this stage?
They weren't. We thought they were, because they were coming so close, but they weren't actually shooting at us. They were shooting at Sea Squadron, and they'd shot our troop leader. Anyway, they stopped firing after a while. They ran out of, I mean, they'd more or less run out of targets, I suppose, with Sea Squadron, so they stopped firing. So the corporal, while this had been going on, he'd spotted some what looked like German activity a few hundred yards ahead, behind the other side of a hedge. So I said, so he had us firing HE through this hedge, into the hedge and through it, until he saw a flash or two that it hit something, and so he called it off at that. Then he traversed right onto, there were some three haystacks, about 50 yards away or so, and he traversed right onto those, and when he traversed right onto those, I could then see through my periscope, I only had a limited view, I could then see the troop leader's tank blazing away. He was about 100 yards in front of us. And also, looking farther to the right, I could see all these other columns of black smoke going up from Sea Squadron's tanks, which were blazing away. I thought, well, things are pretty grim. Anyway, we put an HE into each of these three haystacks, which completely flattened each one. And lo and behold, there were two anti-tank guns there hiding behind them, but nobody with them. So whether they'd just been abandoned or what, I don't know, but two enemy anti-tank guns hiding behind these two haystacks. By this time, the record driver, Cliff at Pembroke, had dropped his SK patch down, and he looked underneath to see what was wrong, and then told us that we bellied on this log. And having a look at it all, he said to the driver, if you go forward on your right and back on your left or something like that, forward on your right and brake your left, and he did this sort of thing, and eventually we wriggled off it. So we turned round and went back a bit to the next hedge.
Sorry.
Behind us.
So you went, you didn't go over the hedge, you just come over, you went back along?
Yeah, we went back over the hedge, we'd just come over, back to the next hedge, where the other two tanks of the troop were sheltering behind the next hedge, you see, and we joined them, still facing this, where this gunpowder had come from, which was actually from the region of Cagney. Now, the other two tanks had sergeants in charge, and one of them was Sergeant Truscott, the troop sergeant, so we were under his command then, and we stayed there a long time. But nothing happened for a long time, and there was nobody near us, no activity near us, so we backed up some more, and then eventually we're still on our own, no sign of anybody after a bit. But then,
so you're in an isolated position?
Yeah, just watching, facing Cagney. But after a while, the padre arrived, what we call the blood wagon, which was a half-track, half-track ambulance, dropped the padre off, and a couple of stretchers, and somebody came up with some prisoners.
Now, what was the padre doing?
Well, he used to help the wounded, you see. And I'm just trying to think. A tank came and dropped some wounded off the back near us and lay them out on the ground. And somebody, I don't know who it was, came up with some prisoners. It must have been some of our chaps who got shot out of the tank, I think. And the padre got two of the prisoners, two older men, some were younger, two of the older men. He gave them a Red Cross armband and a stretcher, and he sent them out looking for wounded. And they started bringing more wounded in, and they lay out these wounded on the ground. And also, I think it was, by then it was getting towards the afternoon, and some infantry of the Guards Armoured arrived, Guards Armoured Division Infantry, and they all marched off, heading towards Cagney, towards where these guns had been. So we then took it very easy, and we broke open the new ration pack, and we got the tin of peaches out, and we opened the tin of peaches, and we ate the tin of peaches.
So you hadn't been under fire for a while?
No, nothing had happened there, just there. The rest of the regiment was about 2 miles ahead of us, being shot to bits.
But you were legitimately, you'd been watching the left flank, because you were facing.
Well, we'd been told to do that, and that's what they'd done. Now,
what happened next?
Well, our corporal just took orders from the troop sergeant, and the troop sergeant said we were staying there. And I think the one reason why we were staying there was they couldn't make contact with the squadron leader. Because I think all the squadron leaders, all the HQ tanks and the squadron leader's tanks had all been knocked out. So they couldn't make wireless contact with anybody, so he was staying where he was. And he stayed where he was all the time. Now, another tank came to join us. It was Captain Treherne's tank, and he'd been shot through the head. And this tank came to join us. Now, what they'd done with Tank Captain Treherne, I don't know. They must have taken him out and left him out of the tank somewhere. But they were a bit demoralised, and they didn't want. They sort of come backwards to where we were. So there were four tanks there, which would have been a useful reinforcement for the regiment. But we just stayed there, and as we were going down, the sergeant said, right, and we set off rearwards towards where the echelon was.
So,
and we parked there.
Which probably wasn't what they were meant to do, but there was no...
Well, I suppose whether he was uncertain or just avoiding battle, I don't know, but we went backwards anyway to where the echelon was. And then as it went, as it was going dark, we brewed up, and as it was going dark, we got some mugs out, and I said, oh, well, some of the mugs were inside the tank, so I climbed on the tank and got inside to get the mugs. As I was climbing on the tank,